This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under-the-radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth. We're going into the start of summer, and lawmakers in Lansing worked feverishly this week on a budget and other projects in order to now start their summer break. Here with me to dig into everything going on at the Capitol is Detroit News reporter Beth LeBlanc. Hey, Beth.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
We have a budget. It took them a little bit. What were some of the big sticking points that held up the process this year?
Well, you know, surprisingly, and I'm not sure many people anticipated this, but this was the first, Democratic trifecta that we've had in the state in 40 years. And as they soon discovered, there's a little bit of a learning curve to passing the state budget. It's not exactly an easy task for the majority. So there was a little bit of sorting through, you know, how you go about it, how you meet everyone's demands for what should be in the budget. So that was a little bit of a sticking point in terms of any sort of delay. But they still got it before the July 1st deadline that they put in place a few years ago. So they still were on track and on time. But the other kind of sticking point here is that although the Democrats have majorities in the House and Senate, they are very narrow majorities, and they had to get some GOP buy-in into this budget in order for it to pass. So there were some concessions that were made for Republicans at different points in the budget. All of those, I don't think we have a full picture of yet because we're still kind of sorting through it. But especially in the House, there's a one vote margin. So if any kind of Democratic member has an issue with the budget, they have to get Republican buy-in. And then in the Senate, they need support from at least some Republicans in order to get immediate effect for the budget. So for it to go into place in time for the next fiscal year, they had to get some Republicans on board.
What were some of the big points that Republicans and Democrats had to agree on? What were some of the big things that they were kind of having to both make some compromises on?
Yeah, you know, I think there was a little bit of horse trading in terms of different projects, different, tax credits or incentives. Also, some of the lawmakers' pet projects, we saw a few that were in Republican-leaning districts. And I think we can assume that that was, you know, a little bit of an olive branch to Republicans in order to get them on board with the budget. But in House floor speeches, we heard a lot of lawmakers finding some common ground on education spending, the idea of increasing, you know, foundational allowances and then increasing like special ed funding and everything. We found a little bit of bipartisan support. It doesn't mean they got a lot of Republican votes for either of these budgets, but there was some there. And I think there was some consensus on some of those.
Give us the broad strokes of what is in the budget. What should people really know about how much is being spent and where?
Yeah, so this was an $82 billion budget, and it's historic because we've never had one that big before. And it kind of follows this trend over the past few years of a growing state budget, in part because of like federal dollars that have come into the state because of COVID relief and infrastructure grants and CHIPS Act dollars. But also because Michigan during the pandemic, I think much to many economists' surprise, the tax revenue increased during the pandemic, and Michigan actually brought in more tax revenue than it expected. Now, economists are saying that's going to slow down or all out stop in the future. So it's not clear whether Michigan will be able to sustain a budget like this into the future. But it's very large. I mean, we saw big increases in education funding, big increases in like environmental, the environmental department, a lot of what we call pet projects for lawmakers again. And this is increasingly more common too, where lawmakers can kind of bargain for, dedicated projects to their districts. We saw at least $760 million in pet projects last night. So there was a lot going on. There's a lot in the budget. To tell you the truth, we're still unpacking it too. And this was one of the critiques that Republicans had this time. Democrats have criticized in the past is that these budgets, yeah, versions of them are out there, you know, weeks ahead of time. But the actual final version gets unveiled to the public, to the lawmakers who are voting on it, mere hours before they have to vote on it. And these are, you know, one budget was 1,100 pages. The other one was hundreds of pages. So there's no way for lawmakers to read fully through this budget before they vote on it. There's just absolutely no way. So that's been one of the critiques that definitely happened yesterday. You know, they're given certain summaries and high level overviews, but they can't really get into the brass tacks before voting on it.
I'm very curious about what they've done with environmental spending. You mentioned the environmental department. I know here in Grand Rapids this week, we've had some very, very poor air quality because of the fires in Canada. So that's sort of gotten a lot of people thinking about pollution and environmental concerns. Talk us through sort of what happened in that sphere during the budget.
Yeah, so we saw big increases in FTEs in the Eagle budget. So FTEs is full-time employees. They're going to have a lot more staff on. There are different programming that had big increases, be it for, you know, water safety or water affordability or the cleanliness of water at the end of the day, but then also remediation money. So they can go into sites that have like a history of environmental issues and they can go in and clean up those sites. And we saw that not only in the environmental budget, but also in some of like the economic development budget, right? Like these brownfield grants. Recently, they've increased what they can do with brownfield grants, which are grants given to companies or tax incentives basically given to companies who want to go into like a, you know, a big industrial site, clean it up and rebuild. So there are a lot of those programs going on. I think that's another one we're still digging into to understand the breadth of what was passed. But there are definite increases in that sense.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Were there any surprises in the budget this year that we know of so far? Who knows what's really lingering in the fine print?
Give us a few weeks and we'll be back. But I think, you know, it wasn't too surprising the size of the budget, but it also shouldn't go without being noted that this was massive. You know, not only did you have the $82 billion annual budget, what they passed yesterday also included a $5 billion supplemental for the current year. So in total, they authorized about $87 billion in spending. Compare that to last year's budget when it was passed, it was $76 billion. So you saw big increases there. And I think there's a little bit of concern that we heard last night. Are those increases sustainable? Can we keep the programming and the full-time employees that we've hired if there's an economic downturn? So that was a little bit surprising. You know, that we're always keeping an eye out on the pet projects for different districts. And there were a couple of interesting ones in there. $900,000 for a cricket field in Troy. Yeah, really out of the blue there.
Is there a lot of cricket being played in Troy?
You know, I don't know, apparently. One lawmaker said he wasn't sure if it was the sport or for the insect, and he's still trying to figure it out. There were a lot of things in there, you know, a lot of money for splash pads, for pools, you know, those sorts of things that, yeah, I'm sure communities are overjoyed to get the money. But I think also lawmakers are wondering how did they get in line for this or how did they get to the front of the line for this? But we also saw a couple of groups that saw increased funding, but also it was less of an increase than they wanted. And then what was proposed initially in like the governor's initial executive recommendation. So one of those groups is, you know, local communities, local governments, cities, townships. It's long been a complaint of theirs that they're not getting enough in revenue sharing and they're having trouble making ends meet without the state sharing more of the tax revenue that they help collect. they were initially promised some really big increase, both one time and sustained. Those were cut quite a bit in the budget that ultimately passed last night. We also heard this morning from direct care workers who expected a bigger bump in their pay, the state to subsidize some of that. And there was a bump in their pay. It just wasn't as large as they had hoped. So there were a few things that definitely stood out. Like you said, we're still going through the budget. It's going to take us a while, but I'm sure there will be more. Stay tuned.
Well, since the legislature's on their summer break, let's talk about some of the things that they got accomplished and are still going to be working on when they return in the fall. On Tuesday, the Michigan House panel voted to give another $120 million toward a Ford Motor Company. Talk us through what's going on there and how they came to this amount and what it's going to be for.
Yeah, so this is a kind of an ongoing process that began in February when Ford announced that it would be building an EV battery plant park in the Marshall area. And so this is part of the incentive package that was offered to Ford to build that battery plant in Marshall. It's a $3.5 billion development. They're getting about $1.6 billion in tax incentives and tax abatements when all is said and done. So this $120 million was one of the last pieces that had to put in place and be put in place in terms of incentives. And it'll be used to like prepare the site for Ford. So it will they'll be cleaning up the land, getting it ready for a project of this scale.
Was this a controversial move or was this something that both sides were agreeing on?
You know, it's that's a complicated question. It depends on who you ask. A lot of these projects that they've landed for these communities, you know, huge projects, all kind of centered around EVs and battery production and semiconductors. They've been hailed as like huge investments for the state, but the communities that are getting them in are not entirely excited. There are definitely folks who are protesting who don't want these companies in part because they feel like it was kind of just like launched on them all of a sudden, saying we have this project is coming. Your board's already agreed to it essentially and is coming. Others concerned about the incentive offers that were offered them. Others feeling like, why are they coming into rural areas when there are a lot of abandoned industrial sites elsewhere in the state? And then others, for the Marshall plant and for the Big Rapids one in particular, they're concerned about both companies have links to China, in part because China has like cutting edge technology when it comes to battery plant production and everything. So like Ford is licensing technology from a Chinese company. So the community is a little bit upset about that and is trying to fight it from coming in. So there is some community pushback, and I think you see that when it comes to the votes to authorize this money as well. Different lawmakers are voicing similar concerns to residents. So it should be interesting how it plays out. This has been a big push over the last few years from the state of Michigan. And for the most part, when they're announced, at least initially, they're pretty well welcomed into a community. But then once details start coming out and once people kind of realize the size of these projects, there are a lot of reservations about it.
Michigan lawmakers approved a measure to allow alcohol sales at university sporting events. This is something that we've been following a little bit over here on Mishmash. Is Governor Whitmer expected to sign this? And why has this gotten so much support now?
Yeah, I think it's been a bill that's kind of been introduced repeatedly throughout the different years. This time it landed and they're pushing it through. And yeah, I think we can expect the governor to sign this and for alcohol sales to be available come, you know, the fall football season. This is one that had pretty wide support, but there were others. There were a few people speaking on the floor when this passed saying, look, like, we've got people tailgating, we've got people drinking inside. Do we really want to encourage this culture in, you know, around a college game? I don't know that there's any putting the genie back in the bottle when it comes to drinking around college games. But they feel like maybe this is just admitting defeat a little bit too much, or allowing this on a scale that we haven't seen before.
How are the universities sort of preparing for this, and what is this going to mean for them?
The university boards will have to apply to the Michigan Liquor Control Commission for licenses to sell alcohol. And then those licenses will allow them to sell alcohol for a limited number of days on college, at college stadiums or arenas. So, you know, you've got football, basketball, hockey, those sorts of sports, they'd be able to sell them at those. So the universities kind of pick and choose which days they sell them. But I think there are enough days available under the licenses they're eligible for that they'd be able to essentially sell them at every game.
There have been rumors and murmurs going on at the Capitol that this is going to be the year of a transparency overhaul. This is something that some lawmakers have been working on for years. In the case of Senator Jeremy Moss, his entire time at the Capitol, he has been attempting to change the state's transparency laws. What are some of the details that you've been able to glean on all of this? What's the latest?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of reporters who are interested in seeing these go through so we can get certain documents or certain information, it would have been dangerous to hold our breath over the past few years because it kept getting introduced and then never really went anywhere. But in this case, this year, it does appear to be different. In terms of financial disclosures, lawmakers are actually obligated. They have to form a financial disclosure policy because it was part of Proposal 1 that passed in November that they would have to develop a financial disclosure policy for lawmakers. So I think we can definitely see that. They have no choice but to pass a financial disclosure policy. I think there's a lot of attention to how they pass it because the devil's in the details in terms of how strict they make that financial disclosure requirement. Besides that, you know, we've heard a lot of ideas kind of tossed around that have been in the lineup for a long time, but never able to get across the finish line, like subjecting the legislature and the governor to Freedom of Information Act requests. They are exempt currently, so we cannot file public records requests for, let's say, the emails of a lawmaker or the emails of the governor or even somebody in the governor's office. They're also discussing, you know, different lobbying disclosure requirements to tighten up our lobbyist laws, different campaign finance laws, how lawmakers can use the money that they've raised, be it from a traditional campaign account or from a nonprofit that they've set up to fundraise for them, what they have to disclose, how they can use the money. Those are some of the ideas that are being tossed around right now. And that we're likely to see when they return in the fall.
Let's do a big picture catch up on what else the legislature's been up to. They've passed measures to make Juneteenth a public holiday, a conversion therapy ban, some early voting measures. What has stood out to you about what the legislature has been sending to Governor Whitmer's desk?
I think the last time we talked actually was after that first few months in the legislature when we just saw just this all out push to get some policy objectives across the finish line, right? In terms of reversing right to work, repealing or putting back in place the prevailing wage policy, different issues like that. I think we saw a continuation of that in the last 3 months and in basically through the first half of the year. We saw a lot of legislation moving through, some of it getting to the finish line in terms of making it easier for unions to operate in the state and giving them more power at the bargaining table, especially when it comes to teachers. We've seen a lot of changes to the way teachers' unions are able to bargain. So I think there's been a big emphasis on the union legislation that's been going through. And obviously it's more favorable to unions than it probably would have been under a Republican majority. I think we also saw a lot of like civil rights and social issue bills that have gone across, be it, you know, changes to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, a conversion therapy ban, different. There's bills that have passed that would strengthen the state's laws surrounding like hate crimes or the desecration of an institution like a church or a synagogue or what have you. So there have been a lot of bills in that vein. And we'll see, you know, kind of whether that continues in the fall or whether they're going to work on bills that are more mainstream at that point.
Beth LeBlanc is a Capitol reporter for the Detroit News. Beth, it is always such a pleasure to have you here on Mishmash.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station. This episode was produced by myself, Shayna Roth, and the man, the myth, the legend, Hearns Laguerre Jr. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. Our digital team is Dave Kim and Sophia Joswiak, with additional help from Jack Philbrandt. As always, if you listen to this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so. Just go online and leave us a review. Or if you really, really like this podcast, and we really hope you do, you can support WDET by going to wdet.org/give. Again, that's wdet.org/give. Without your support, programs like Mishmash are really not possible. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you next week.